You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the Midside, where if talking to Asian girls were equivalent to soliciting prostitution, I'd be in jail for life. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you have no idea what I'm talking about, then you are probably similar to a lot of people in the country right now, but there was a lot to talk about on this week's Midside, so why don't you tell a friend about how great this episode is before you even listen to it? Just pause it right now and just text a bunch of people. Hey, this episode of the Midside I'm listening to, I know it's going to be really, really good, because anything called the Robert Kraft edition is going to be good. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Oh, Bobby Kraft, what are you doing with your life? What are you doing, 80-year-old man? We'll get into that in a minute in the news, but I want to say that I just got back from a wedding in Florida, in Fort Myers, and my dog is going nuts all of a sudden. I don't know if you can hear that on the recording. I hope not, but alas, he's excited to see me. Justin, Florida is just better than most places. True or false?
True, and what I would like to say about stories like this is a result of freedom. It's not a negative thing. This is what happens when you have freedom. Random shit happens. You just got to deal with it. It's much better than the opposite of which is what you get in California.
Yeah. And I know Florida is going to play into our discussion of Bob Kraft here in a minute, but I'll have to say I was in Fort Myers, which is arguably not even the best part of Florida, probably bottom half of places to go in Florida. And it was still just, you just felt freer. Being there, it felt like it was a little bit more America than some places. I don't know, like DC or LA. So I don't know, just want to throw that out there and say congrats to Midsider Matt, who got married this weekend, and I got to officiate yet another wedding. Make that 4 for 5 in my adult life of weddings I've attended, I've officiated. So,
Side gig. You said 4 for 5. I was like, what, did you try to officiate a wedding and you failed at one? Like 4 for 5. So they both said no when I asked if they did.
Well, there was that one. That's on right. The Titanic, and it just didn't work out.
One was a Jewish wedding, and I can't bring myself to go through the commitment to become a rabbi in order to marry people. So I did have to be officially ordained for this wedding, the first time I've had to actually get an ordination in order to perform. So I'll say that about Florida. They're a little more bureaucratic when it comes to wedding stuff than most other states, but still not bad. But now you can call me officially the Reverend Daniel T. Richards. So you're welcome, everyone.
And I learned a new word, ordination. I had never heard that word before. So There you go. Also joining us this trip. Oh, you made it. Okay. That's why I just learned it.
I don't know. I assume it's a word, but
also joining us this trip from Dale's Lawn, forgoing his gay white male privilege to identify as a woman, William Green.
Hello, hello. We're recording live on Discord. We've got an audience, a live studio audience, which means we'll eventually have the clapping drop. So I can pretend like we have a laugh track and a clap track. Yeah, that would be great. It's my birthday today, 39 years young.
What?
I went out last night, had a bunch of friends come over and went to a whiskey bar and drank some delicious whiskeys, and overall had a good time chatting and laughing, and got some nice new ridiculous board games to play, including a Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? So I'm looking forward to doing that as well. So
where does that have a rockapella drop on it?
Actually, when you open the instructions, it does play the Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego drop. It's fucking
you're
amazing.
Lying.
I am not lying.
Sign me up.
Wow.
I was like, oh, this might be fun, and then I open the instruction book and it plays a song. I'm like, we're playing this game.
Daniel, remember when we saw rockapella at Clemson?
I do. I'm into the acapella genre overall, and rockapella was a big part of my childhood with the Carmen Sandiego show. Yeah. So it was excellent. William, did the whiskey bar have a birthday song for you?
No, they did not.
No. I remember once going to, I think it was Red Lobster for one of my mother's birthdays, and they had a unique birthday song that I hadn't heard anywhere else yet, and I will sing it for you now since you did not get it last night, which is, this is the birthday song. It doesn't last very long. Hey.
Wow.
So happy birthday, William.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, William. We're glad that you were willing to record with us on your birthday. Are you ready for some news?
I am ready.
Let's do it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Well, once again, we thank you for tuning into this episode. And if you enjoy not only the news, but any part of the show, really, then you should join us on patreon.com/themidside and help us keep the lights on. Patreon's a platform that allows you to pay a couple bucks, a buck, 50 cents, whatever you want to pay every time we create a piece of content. And it really helps us do things like buy me a microphone someday. Justin keeps talking about it. It's becoming a running joke, but someday we'll get there.
You just shamed me in front of the audience to get a microphone.
I do what I can. In the meantime, something that Patreon money will not buy, maybe Robert Kraft should take a lesson here. Robert Kraft this week, owner of the New England Patriots, you may have heard of this team once or twice on this show. He's the owner of the Patriots, and this week he was charged with soliciting prostitution. Yes. So here's what we know about this case. This comes from a Sports Illustrated article. Last Tuesday, William Snyder, the sheriff of Martin County in South Florida, announced the uncovering of what he described as a human trafficking ring linked to illegal sex work at several day spas across the area. And he promised that there would be a newsmaker among the clients who received paid sexual acts at these businesses. We now know that the newsmaker is 77-year-old Patriots owner Robert Kraft. And he was charged with going into the Orchids of Asia Day Spa and soliciting an illegal sex act, which could have been a happy ending of some sort. We don't know, but it wasn't. As Bill Clinton would say, it wasn't sex. We just know it was a sexual act. We don't know any more than that. The police claim that there is a video of this, which is interesting. But it all started when there were some claims or some concerns that there might be some human trafficking going on at this day spa and others in the area, when it was found out that people were living and sleeping in the day spas, for instance, in Jupiter, Florida. And so police conducted a sting. And so Robert Kraft has been caught up in this. He, of course, claims that he did nothing illegal. And he, in fact, categorically denied any illegal involvement with this. So, Justin, seems like the Patriots were due for a scandal. Is this the scandal the Patriots needed right now?
This is exactly the scandal the Patriots needed right now. And that's one of the two angles to go at this with. And I guess we'll go at this from this angle first before we go at the political cultural angle. But the next Super Bowl is in Miami. And Daniel, where are the two places that Tom Brady cannot win a football game?
Denver and Miami.
Right. Like, crazy shit just happens in Miami. So it always seems like whenever the Patriots are done winning, right, it's sort of like they won their sixth. They're tied for most franchise Super Bowls ever. They have no motivation. Brady's going to be 42. Like, how are they possibly going to win in a Super Bowl in Miami, especially when they have all these free agents? Then they just decide, we're going to poke the bear. That's like what the rest of the world decides. They're like, hey, you know, maybe we're finally done with the Patriots. Let's just piss them off again so they win another title. And this is the thing that people don't realize. Jupiter is not far from Miami. When you say South Florida, it is literally next to Miami. Maybe one of you can look up how many miles it is from Miami, but people from Jupiter tell people they're from Miami. You are not going to convince me otherwise that this wasn't a Miami Dolphins fan who did this.
Who did what?
This is an attempt to tear down the Patriots. You have people now saying that Kraft should be forced to sell the team, that because he is subject to the same player conduct policies, he should be forced to sell the team like the Clippers owner was for saying the N-word, even though he had a black girlfriend, and they should give up draft picks because of this. This is literally just their... Kraft stood up there after the sixth Super Bowl and was basically like, this is for Brady and Belichick. I can already see Brady standing up there and saying, this is for Kraft.
What would the slogan be for that Super Bowl run, Justin?
Well, I have to give credit to Barstool Sports. I watched a four-minute clip on the Tucker Carlson show, and the guy from Barstool Sports has the perfect hashtag, coming for seven.
Well, I just looked it up. It is 88 miles from Jupiter, Florida to downtown Miami. But I also looked up it's 156 miles from Fort Myers. So, Daniel, did you partake in this this establishment?
I was not caught up in any sting, nor did I participate in any massage parlors, not the least of which is because I just actually hate massages.
How could you not go to a place called Orchids of Asia, though?
You know, that's really sort of oddly coincidental or not. I'm not sure. The wedding venue at which the wedding took place in Fort Myers was called the White Orchid.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. But it had white right in the name, so it had nothing to do with Asia.
Likely cover story.
That's right. William, before we jump into some broader cultural stuff here, it shouldn't go without saying that we don't know a ton of information about this case. So there's still a lot of information to come out about what the hell actually went on and what Kraft actually engaged in. But
if it was even him, can I just point out before you continue, if he's not wearing his blue powder collar and his red tie, doesn't he just look like a generic white dude?
Is that going to be the defense? I could be any white guy.
Well, we are talking about old people in Florida. Like,
that's
what I'm
saying.
This is quite a lineup.
An old Jewish white guy in Florida. Like,
but maybe we should ask a pointed libertarian question here, which is assuming that like Robert Kraft is not, you know, single-handedly running a human trafficking ring here, but instead being a 77-year-old man whose wife of 40-some years died and he's a little bit lonely, so he goes into a joint and asks for a handy. Is this behavior that's illegal, despicable, and more like, what are we even talking about here in terms of morality, law, go?
Yeah, it's interesting that we focus on the Johns and not the human trafficking side, right? Like, that side's pretty... Like, this is a scandal because it's a famous person as one of the Johns. There's a little bit of... would this be called slut-shaming if it was the other way around? That's kind of an interesting thing to think about. I mean, I don't really care about people getting hand jobs. I'm more interested in... I care about me getting a hand job, but that's totally different. I don't care about other people getting hand jobs. I care about, like, you know, they're talking about in the article the evidence that possibly people were living there and there might be some sex trafficking. Well, that's a serious problem.
Yeah, and it's so that the question is, like, should this be illegal because people who engage in it are encouraging sex trafficking? Or is it the fact that it's illegal, the fact that there's a prohibition on it, that makes the human sex trafficking element even possible? If it wasn't something that was illegal, but it was something that was more out in the open, wouldn't it be better regulated first by a marketplace and then second by, you know, the proper government involvement?
I can imagine the Yelp reviews for hand jobs. That would be that would be amazing. I think I want to live in this libertarian world.
I think Robert Kraft's Yelp review would be a lot easier than jerking off with six Super Bowl rings on.
Talk about chafing. Yeah. So, Justin, I know there are some cultural ramifications here that you need to discuss. Why don't you dive right in?
Well, I mean, what you just said sounded exactly like a description of the war on drugs, didn't it?
Maybe a little bit.
I mean, like, exactly the same thing. This is one of those where in our society, we can't differentiate between what we should do and what we should legislate. And there is a huge difference here, right? Why are you going to this kind of place? Even Robert Kraft, I would ask, if he did indeed go to this place, it's like, why are you going to this place? You already have a legal prostitute and your 39-year-old girlfriend. Like, what are you getting out of going to this place? And I guess it's just the convenience factor. But even then, if you're just doing things purely based on convenience, what are you eating McDonald's all day and you're seeing Marvel movies? I mean, that's what this is akin to, right? It's like you go to a Marvel movie, you eat McDonald's, and then you go to Orchids of Asia. Like,
I don't know. Like, maybe they have a 5-star hand job review there. Maybe they're just really talented. You don't know that that's the McDonald's of hand jobs.
And you're telling me a guy worth $6.6 billion couldn't get a 39-year-old girlfriend who gives him 5-star hand jobs and more.
Well, I guess you're right. I guess you're right.
Right. Yeah. There's so many marketplace solutions to this other than the way right. Orchids.
And that's the point I'm making is, why do we care? Like, why do we care from a legislative standpoint? From a moral standpoint, we can talk about what you should and shouldn't do, right? All day, we can have that discussion. I mean, I'm straight edge, so I'm going to be pretty hardcore on the edge of what you shouldn't do.
Oh,
right?
Are you anti-handjob?
Hey, I'm anti go news. To a show and get a random hand job from a random person. That's what I'm anti. Okay. If all somebody's right. going to touch your junk, they should be worthy of touching your junk. That's all I'm saying. That is a 6-time Super Bowl winning penis, and you're going to let someone random touch it? Really? But that's a different discussion.
Justin, don't put the penis on a pedestal. Okay.
It's a good reference. No, that's a different discussion. The discussion here is, why do we think as a country we need to legislate morality in this way? Let's use the leftist logic here, right? Of your body, your choice, right? Her body, her choice.
Yeah.
Well, why is it not the same thing here? His body, his choice. Her body, her choice. Why are we legislating other people's sexual actions? Well, they can and can't do.
That goes to my question, which I'm trying to not be just an apologist for Robert Kraft and the Patriots here. The question is more so, does this kind of marketplace encourage sex trafficking? Does it encourage forcing people into sex slavery to do these things? That's the question.
I would not use the word encourage, whereas in the war on drugs, it encourages it because the drugs have to be smuggled in from other places that it's easier to manufacture. Here in this country, you can always sell your own body, right? It's not like that's a commodity that can only be gotten in other countries that has to be smuggled in. So I don't think it encourages the sex trafficking, but I think it makes it much harder to enforce from a police standpoint. Because we have such a low threshold for what's illegal for sex crimes. They're not even able to give the proper resources and have the proper market to be able to look at what is legal and what isn't. It's all illegal, which makes the harder stuff harder to crack down upon.
Harder.
I want to know who pays for a handy with a credit card. That's the other thing that I was reading through this. I was like, wow. Wow.
So isn't it? I don't know. So let's first of all make sure, Justin, that you and I aren't being apologists for the Patriots and anything to do with the New England Patriots. Would we feel this way if it was like the owner of the Jets, for instance, or the owner of the Broncos?
I'd be more sympathetic if it was the owner of the Jets. At least it makes sense if he feels bad after a game and has to go and get one. Well, I'd be like, dude, just let the guy have what he can have. I'm less sympathetic with Kraft. Why are you doing this, Bob Kraft? Why are you putting yourself in this position? Yeah, if it was the owner of the Jets, I'd be like, okay, fine. It should be legal in New York City. Like, why are we hassling this guy? His team sucks. He just wants to have a little bit of fun. Just let him feel a little bit of pleasure. Why is the government telling him he can't feel a little bit of pleasure?
It's also, it seems, you know, again, being very clear, the sex trafficking part is the horrific part of this and should be, I mean, it obviously is illegal, but should be cracked down on. That is the proper use of government. That is actually a time in which I want government cracking down. But on just the prostitution side of this, it seems almost arbitrary that you're allowed to have, for instance, a full body massage where they can touch you anywhere except one place. And if they touch you in that one place, then it's prostitution. What I mean,
yeah, does it matter? What if they touch you? What if they touch you? Like, is it just the touching or is the orgasm required? They were like super specific about like there was semen. They found semen. Like, is it like,
I'm glad you asked that, William.
They have there.
I didn't want to be the pervert to ask that question. But yeah, like what if they touch you and like you get half a chubby?
Yeah, it's all unusual to me that this is the realm of government. It's unusual to me that the government inserts itself here and says, we're going to write a law that distinguishes between touching you in one place, I use the word on purpose, and touching you in another place. And we're going to codify this with statutes. Like, that just seems totally ludicrous to me. It's something that should not be worried about. In fact, I think, same with the war on drugs, if this was something that was legal, if it was something that allowed, there'd be far less incentive to traffic people because there would be people who choose to do this and you wouldn't be able to compete in the marketplace with the sex trafficking stuff. There would be no incentive to do it. So,
but I have another question based on this.
A consequence of too much government involvement.
Oh, it's 100% a consequence of that. And speaking of that, and we're talking about, like, where is the line? Like, don't certain people have certain fetishes? Like, what if somebody goes in and gets a foot massage and has an orgasm because they have a foot fetish? Like, does that become a sex crime? Does that become prostitution? Or what if, like, somebody who's hypersensitive to physical touch? Like, what if an autistic person goes in and gets a massage? Is that prostitution?
Yeah, I don't know. There's probably legal definitions here that would make anyone blush in terms of the type of language they use to describe it. But overall, again, it's just a matter of what the hell are we really doing here? What the hell do we really want from government here? It seems to make no sense.
Well, and then there's also the media narrative, too, where let's not forget that it's really just misdemeanors here. Like, as you said, this is a sting for human sex trafficking where there were multiple massage parlors involved. And then they have these local residents who went in and got whatever they got, rub and tugs, we'll say, and they're only being charged with misdemeanors. So at most, their craft is subject to 60 days in jail and a $500 fine. It's not even anything super serious. And they keep saying arrest warrant. Well, if you lived in the state, it would only be a court summons. It's only an arrest warrant in the technicality that he lives out of the state and they just want him to come to court. So it's right. All even the law isn't treating being a John as anything serious, but the media is for two reasons.
This is okay. You go with the two, and then I have a transition that will fit both. Yeah.
So the first reason is just anti-patriots rhetoric, but the second is this moralizing we do in this country, where we're moralizing. Oh, how dare this man have gone and paid for a sexual act if he did indeed do that? But how dare a man do that? How dare he? That is so reprehensible. That makes him a terrible person.
Yes, indeed. So part of this, to me, is the spectacle created by the police department themselves, like coming out and saying
Dolphins,
you know,
fans,
press conferences, and talking about how this is a newsmaker. You're gonna wanna stay tuned to find out more. And this seems to me an abrogation of what the justice system is supposed to do overall. And this ties in a little bit, and maybe more than a little bit, with what we're about to talk about in the next story, which is Jussie Smollett. So a judge in Chicago has scolded Smollett over his allegations he staged a racist anti-gay attack, calling it vile and despicable. So this is from the Chicago Trib. A Cook County judge scolded Jussie Smollett as he set bond Thursday at $100,000 on charges that the Empire actor staged an attack on himself. He said, quote, "The most vile and despicable part of it, if it's true, is the noose," said Judge John Fitzgerald Like Jr. "That symbol conjures up such evil in this country's history. The judge himself is black," the article points out. And this comes after the police chief in Chicago held a press conference to essentially scold Jussie Smollett for staging this attack and ruining the city of Chicago, and et cetera. So Smollett's now posted bail. But this is what I want to get into in this story, and you can respond or ignore me all you want. But his lawyers essentially responded, you know, how you would expect lawyers to respond, but in a way that I'm actually somewhat sympathetic with. So his legal team called the allegations, quote, "part of an organized law enforcement spectacle that has no place in the American legal system." The quote continues, "the presumption of innocence, a bedrock in the search for justice, was trampled upon at the expense of Mr. Smollett, and notably on the eve of a mayoral election. Mr. Smollett is a young man of impeccable character and integrity who fiercely and solemnly maintains his innocence and feels betrayed by a system that apparently wants to skip due process and proceed directly to sentencing," end quote. So Justin, this is my question for you. Commentators like us, or Fox News people or Rush Limbaugh, whomever, you know, are going to jump all day, Jesse, and then talk about how vile it is to stage an attack, et cetera, based on the available evidence. But is this really what we want our justice system doing? Do we want our police chiefs and judges out there scolding him because they know it's going to make the nightly news?
Before we get into that, I would like to make a connection to professional football in New England here, because I can. John Fitzgerald is actually the name of a center who played for the Dallas Cowboys and won 2 Super Bowl titles and grew up in the same town as my dad. So there you go. More connection. This all week just connects to football in New England. So just,
thank you for that sidebar.
I just heard the name John Fitzgerald. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I remember the stories my dad used to tell about seeing that guy training. Anyway, I agree with you completely, Daniel. You actually pointed out a subtlety in this story that a lot of people don't realize. Is everyone's like, oh, yeah, this shows how corrupt Jesse Smollett is, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I agree with all that, and we can get into that in a second. But you've pointed out how ridiculous the police are at this point. And this goes to the craft thing. And I don't know if anyone else recently watched the Netflix documentary on Ted Bundy. I think it probably all goes back to that, where, you know, you'd look at OJ even, where we're trying these people in public. And in the Ted Bundy case, they had to move the case from Tallahassee to Miami because the media just completely tainted and the way the police reported on it to the media completely tainted the juror pool. So they had to try Bundy in an area where fewer people knew about him. And it's the same thing here, where this is a complete power play and misuse of the power of the police. They are pissed off that Jesse Smollett did this, and they don't want to be played as fools, so they're bullying him in the media. And it's completely non-objective, and it's completely unjust.
Yeah, William, it seems like the defense here is not going to be that Jesse didn't do it, but the legal team's setting up what I think the defense is going to be is abuse of process. And if Jesse Smollett really did do this, but gets off because of, you know, this
gets
essentially
off.
That's from the last story. Okay. We're on to this story now. We're on to Smollett. If he gets off because the police make it impossible to have a fair trial, that seems like a huge miscarriage of justice. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think that the problem here is the Chicago police are really being shown to be just a bureaucratic and bullying sort of organization, right? Like, just all the leaks that came out and this like manipulation of the press. And you see the in their haste to try and make sure they don't look bad, I think they are setting themselves up for failure here. I mean, especially with Mark Garagos on the case, it's going to be about the police, right?
Mark Garagos, another Patriots connection, keeps saying Kaepernick's going to sign with the Patriots. I could do this all day.
But I guess related to our last story, can't a black gay man in Chicago just pay someone to beat him up and we not make a big media circus about it?
His body, his choice.
His body, his choice.
That's right. But I mean, of course it doesn't go without saying, or shouldn't go without saying, that if it is true that he orchestrated this attack and the preponderance of evidence seemed to suggest that he had something to do with it, or that he lied about it. I mean, I don't even think his lawyers are saying that he didn't do it. It's utterly vile and disgusting. I agree with the judge with those remarks. And he should be a pariah. I'm not sure, you know, you should take his whole livelihood away from him, but it should be something that he pays for in some way, whether through jail time or a fine or whatever, because he is also trying to abuse the justice system in a certain sense, which I think is horrible. But at the same time, this is no different to me an abuse of government power than the last story or other stories that we talk about, where the police are overstepping their bounds, where the government is overstepping its bounds. The ideal role for the government is to be a neutral arbiter of justice, a neutral arbiter of the initiation of force or the initiation of fraud, which is a type of force. And that's it. I don't need them to be moralistic. I don't need them to go out and be woke. I don't want the police chief to want to make news coverage and be seen as the virtuous moral hero here. He is a neutral arbiter. He should be the guy who is stoic, basically reading the charges, etc., moving on, and we should get on with our life.
Well, so he should be Bill Belichick?
Justin,
that's right.
Justin, I see a pattern here, and I want your take on it. I see everyone here in this story has been manipulating the culture of victimhood, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's really obvious with Jesse, right? Like he wanted to be more of a victim so he could make more money, right? The more of a victim he can claim, the more money he thought he could get, the better standing he could get with his charities and things like that. The police are playing the victim. You know, they're saying we were lied to, so therefore we're allowed to act all crazy and bully this person. You've got all these politicians that backed off their statements, their initial statements, also claiming victimhood, right? Saying, oh, well, now, you know, Glenn Beck and, you know, all the Fox News folks, they're going to be all over the story. Again, like they're putting it's all victimhood all the way down.
It's a good point. It's like turtles who hold up the world.
No, I agree completely. I mean, look at the police, right? I think the victimhood of the police is a great thing to point out with Daniel's point about the neutral arbiter. Their argument is going to be, oh, we're victims because they wasted our resources and we could be helping other people with those resources, which granted, that is objectively true, right? You can't argue that. But isn't that the point of having the law in place that you can't make false claims and you can't fake crimes? So if that's true, the best way to punish him is just punish him. And this goes back to the deeper root behind all of this victimhood stuff. And it's the social part of social justice. The police are more concerned about social justice, about shaming him, about making him feel bad, and about ruining his image than they are about actual justice. We are no longer concerned in our social constructivist relativist society about punishing someone in reality. If you just fined him or sent him to jail, he would have been punished for wasting your resources. If you have the evidence on your side, you don't need to get all up in arms and huffity-puffity and all of this crap about it. But because you're so focused on, yeah, I just made up a word, with your adornment or whatever. Ordination of huffity-puffity. No, you don't need to get concerned about all this stuff if you have the evidence on your side. But you're more concerned with social justice than you are justice.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And that goes back to Jesse, you know, and the media trying to paint, America as this MAGA hat wearing racist nation. And you're guilty if you wear a MAGA hat, especially if you have a smirk on your face. And now to the flip side, to the police and the judge, who are trying to play the victim and being more concerned about being woke than they are with being correct. Or following due process.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Which part? But yeah.
Well, the Jesse Smollett in the media part. Because, yeah, we're rightly going after the police, and I'm glad we led with that, Dan, because I think it shows how balanced the mid-side is, and I really think it leads this story properly. But I do want to talk about the Jesse Smollett thing, because I intentionally did not have an opinion on this for a while, because this has been going on for, what, a month, 3 weeks?
That feels like my entire life.
Yeah, yeah. Several news cycles. We'll just put it that way.
Well, how long's a news cycle nowadays? I mean, is it one rub and tug? Like, no, this feels like it's been going on for a while, and I intentionally did not have an opinion. But when it first happened, and my girlfriend shared it with me, and I looked at it, and I said, this does not pass the sniff test. It doesn't. These things do not happen. This is not real. And now to find out he paid two Nigerian guys. First of all, he paid two black guys. Like, if you're going to do it, why wouldn't you pay two white guys? Like, I don't understand. But then you
immigrants
find out he paid
taking jobs Americans won't do. That's what it is.
Build that wall between the U.S. and Nigeria.
Oh, God.
There's not enough racism. We had to import it from Africa.
Right. That's just right. The fact that you would even do any of this. It just shows the arrogance of the media and people in the media to control the narrative. He literally, because he is a gay black man involved in media, involved in Hollywood, he thought he could get away with this because this is the stories they tell us all the time, and we swallow it. we accept it.
Yeah, this gets back to my intro on the show every week, right? I have to forego my gay privilege. It's one of the many privileges I have to forego, but for this reason, so I can stay objective.
Right, so we can sit here and we can talk about the police and Jussie Smollett and all that they're doing wrong, and I agree with everything you're saying, but we have to look at how the media itself creates the culture that makes this able to happen and then also perpetuates it by pushing this story further. Let's not forget, the media wanted this to be true. They would have loved for this to be true.
Yeah, absolutely, because the media in market terms is trying to play up the story that there is, to use the phrase, is more demand for racism than there is actual supply. So anytime there is anything that's remotely racist, they have to make an enormous deal out of it so they can match their false consciousness perception of reality to the quote-unquote world.
I'm just imagining
they take
like
a mountain and make it out of a molehill and make it into a mountain, etc.
I'm just Other imagining questions. What's the guy in Spider-Man, the newsroom guy, like with his cigar, like, and he's got a whiteboard. It's like, we don't have enough racism. We need more racist stories.
Find me racist.
Find
That's right.
me racism.
Well, it's even funnier if you think of Perry White from Zack Snyder's Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman doing it.
Yes.
That's true.
Indeed. It's hysterical. And the left is flipping out about other things this week, including the lack of homophobia from the Trump administration. So this week, the Trump administration launched a worldwide campaign to decriminalize homosexuality, and the left lost its mind. LGBTQNation.com reports, in a surprise move,
surprise,
the Trump administration has announced a global campaign aimed at decriminalizing homosexuality. This move is seen as a thinly veiled attempt to shame Iran for human rights violations. Heaven forbid. The Trump's presidency has been marked by repeated human rights violations and nonstop attacks on the LGBTQ community. At last count, Trump has deliberately taken actions that would harm the LGBT community at least 92 times, according to the article.
List any of the 92?
Yes.
I'll get into that.
I'll get into that.
Okay, I'll let William handle that.
Just let William talk on this story.
Work on his privilege. The initiative is being led by Richard Grenell, Trump's ambassador to Germany. Grenell is an out gay Republican with a long history, according to this article, of making sexist and offensive comments on social media. But nonetheless, the U.S. is leading this effort. And of course, Trump is being held up as a homophobe and anti-LGBTQ for doing this because it's, quote unquote, only a thinly veiled attack on Iran. Justin, Trump derangement, or is there something to this? Is he really veiling his hatred of the LGBTQ by trying to stop them from being stoned to death across the world?
I mean, even if it is like pandering and it's just a political move, wouldn't you be like, oh, I'm glad the guy's pandering to the point that he's helping us? Like, it's sort of like, oh man, that guy only ran that play that resulted in the fumble that we returned for a touchdown. Because he didn't understand our defense. And it's really offensive he didn't understand our defense. I wish he would have run the proper play so we could actually tried harder on defense to stop him. Like, it fucking worked out in your favor. What the fuck are you whining about? This is definitionally Trump derangement syndrome. Although I have an interesting question I want to throw back at you.
Okay.
Where is the line as a libertarian as far as influencing other cultures and respecting individual rights? I believe William talked about this on a previous show, sort of like the prime directive on Star Trek, where you don't interfere in other cultures because their development is like respecting individual rights. Well, this goes to the whole thing, right? Where it used to be, we want to export Americanism, right? We want to export democracy. And many libertarians said that's wrong because other countries have a right to develop how they want. But, and this is, you know, the irony of the left with things like feminism as well, where they support these regimes where they're, you know, anti-women and, you know, stone women to death for showing an ankle. It's the same sort of idea.
Yeah.
Why is it okay to go to Iran and go, hey, stop killing the gays?
So I think exporting American values is perfectly fine. I'm not a libertarian on that point. I think exporting them with guns is probably not fine for the most part, although I think you could have a nuanced discussion about doing that in places like North Korea or Iran, et cetera. But let's just say, for the most part, yeah, I mean, advocating for individual rights around the world through words, through arguments, is, of course, it's okay. We should be doing that. We should be saying our values, our classical liberal Western values, are better than, you know, barbaric throwing gays off of buildings types of values. We should be doing that. You know, sending in an army to stop people from doing it, very different and likely wrong. Although I'm open to discussing why it's wrong and in what context it may not be wrong. And I know that's where some libertarians will obviously pounce on me and call me a statist, but I've been called worse. I'll say that this does remind me of an Adam Carolla-ism where someone will say to him, like, your employee is only, you know, getting here early and doing extra work and, you know, doing all the things that are good for you because they're a brown noser, because they're sucking up. And his response is, good. That's what they should be doing, right? So same thing. If Trump here is just brown nosing, if he's just sucking up, you know, two horrible terms, I know, when we're talking about an article about LGBTQ. But point is, good. Right, William? Because, I mean, obviously you feel attacked every single day by the Trump administration.
I'm glad I gave up my gay privilege, because then I wasn't attacked 92 times by the Trump administration. I think this article and organizations like GLAAD and the Human Rights Campaign, and I think the ACLU also had a nasty tweet about this, are all incredibly evil. This is a huge moral equivalence. I read through the 92 times the LGBTQ community has been attacked by the Trump administration. And you know what was absent from that list? Stoning, throwing people off roofs, forced mutilation, and removing of sexual organs, jail and fines, being accused of prostitution and put in jail because you're homosexual. All those things were missing from those 92 times. Yet we're drawing a moral equivalence, right? Between, you know, Trump is mixed but positive, I would say, in general, for someone who is LGBTQ, LMNOP plus, and interested in individual rights. But he's definitely not if you're a social justice LGBTQ person, right? Like, he's definitely your enemy. But this is. In the intersectional left, it's okay to throw gays off of buildings in Iran and Saudi Arabia, right? Like, that's totally fine. It's brown people doing things to brown people. That's fine. Now, if Trump actually threw someone off the roof 92 times, then I would take this as genuine. But this is just blatant pandering for a political ideology, not actually standing up for the things that they claim to be standing for, especially like GLAAD or the Human Rights Campaign. Like, what did these people stand for? It's the equivalent of when the ACLU came out against free speech, right? And for hate speech laws. This is just it's morally bankrupt.
Yeah, your point is so well taken, William. I'm reading through this list of 92 times the Trump administration.
Thank you. Somebody share what some of them are. I'm really
curious. The LGBTQ community. And to put an even finer point on William's point, what's absent from this list is an attack, like an actual attack.
Yeah, here's one.
I've got some favorites. Yeah. But so my couple favorite that I've seen in here so far. December 22nd, 2017, President Trump signs the GOP tax bill, which targets low-income and LGBTQ communities into law. That's an attack on the LGBTQ community. He lowered the tax burden for people. Here's another good one. President Trump delivers the keynote address at the Anti-LGBTQ Heritage Foundation.
They're anti-LGBTQ. Yeah.
He gave a talk at the Heritage Foundation. That's an attack on LGBTQ. That is total nonsense. The Justice Department are in support of a baker who denied service to a gay couple during the Supreme Court oral arguments for the case Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. An attack on gay people. Any favorites from this list, William?
I like the first one sets the tone. It's talking about Trump had a meeting with Clarence Thomas's wife. It's an attack.
Wait, it really says that?
Yes, President Trump meets with Ginny Thomas, wife of U.S. Supreme Court Justice, and an anti-LGBT group groundswell at the White House. Again, once the group is labeled anti-LGBTQ, if Trump interacts with them in any way, he is therefore attacking the LGBTQ community. This kind of thing it's one of my pet peeves, the conflating of actual violence, like using the word attack, with with ideas, with people who disagree with you. And look, some of these people hold positions that I think are abhorrent, like they would outlaw gay marriage, for instance, which I think is idiotic. But I don't think that is not the same as wanting gay people to be sterilized or throwing them off the roof or stoning them to death. It's just not the same thing. They are wrong, but it is not the same. It is not an equivalent, as William was saying. There is no moral equivalent between the two.
I have a question. Sure, based upon their own sort of standards and their own list, do they have him meeting with Kim Jong-un on that list?
I do not recall that.
Well, wouldn't that be then?
They have nominating Brett Kavanaugh as one of the attacks on the LGBTQ community, just to be clear. So are you saying we should add one, Justin? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I'm not saying we should add one because he was trying to get them to be nuclear disarmament, which would save more gay people.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, just to put a bow on this, like that there's a reason why I can't when I am not on the show and I am exercising my gay privilege that I can't participate or be involved in any of these LGBT groups. And this is the reason why. This moral equivalence and outright evil equivocation between actual, gays being tortured and put to death versus, my feelings were hurt or there was hate speech. I can't get behind organizations like GLAAD or the Human Rights Campaign. Even during the marriage equality stuff, the stuff coming out of the HRC was completely inconsistent with individual rights. It's just not, and seeing the gay and LGBTQ community as, first of all, as one community and one, one entity, one social gestalt of like gayness, all being attacked by Trump, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense, right? There are Republican, like, even in the article, we talk about a Republican gay person, right? Like, there are people with different views in this group of people. And the thing that they share is they like the same sex, right? Like, that's the thing that they share. It's not political ideas that they all share in together, right? And just treating this as one entity, right, is a thing that's always disturbed me.
Well, and let's be clear that this is not limited to homosexuality. This is social justice in general. This is the concept of microaggressions, right? If you say something like, "Oh, what's your ethnicity?" That's a microaggression because it's pointing out that someone is different. And it's happened to companies like Hobby Lobby were anti-women's rights because they didn't want to provide birth control as part of health insurance.
Deny access, I believe.
They wanted to deny access, which made them anti-women's rights. This is all how they control the narrative. They control the narrative and make you think things are true that aren't true. If you were just to read that article without thinking about it and without questioning it, you would be like, wow, Trump's a piece of shit. And then Trump derangement syndrome would set in. This is how they control the narrative.
Yeah. And by the way, Trump very well probably is a POS, but not for these reasons. But speaking of the Trump administration and other things that are going to anger everyone, I don't know, the left mostly, the Trump administration getting set for a major rollback ends its clean air talks with California. So the Trump administration announced Thursday that it has decided to scrap negotiations with California over the president's plan to undo Obama-era fuel efficiency standards for cars and light trucks. The move makes a protracted legal battle almost certain. At the heart of the talks was California's longstanding right, quote unquote, to opt out of national auto emissions rules and set its own tailpipe standards. State officials have vowed to sue to protect the authority if the administration tries to impose weaker federal standards on California and the dozen states that follow its lead. Xavier Becerra, the California Attorney General, said Thursday the state was, quote, prepared to defend our national clean air standards even if the Trump administration intends to go AWOL. A tiny bit of background. Under the rules established by President Barack Obama to cut planet warming greenhouse gas emissions from tailpipes, national fuel economy standards would nearly double by 2025. The Trump administration said in August that it intended to freeze that measure after 2021, when new cars must average around 30 miles a gallon. It also said it would challenge the right of California and the states that follow its lead to set their own rules. So Justin, here, there seems to be a few different things here. Obviously, one is the reason for these emission standards, i.e. to combat catastrophic global warming. And then the second is a federalism issue, which might be interesting, which is, do states have the right to adopt their own emission standards and not have one imposed on them by the federal government? Choose your poison.
Well, I was going to outline the two paths, but you already did. So thanks for taking away a lot of what I was going to say. No, I think the
Thunder
federalism
stolen.
Thing. I think the federalism thing is more something you can talk about. I find it interesting, but I don't know the answer because I'm not enough of an expert on it. But the other side of this is just California again, whether they can have their own standards or not based upon federalism or whatever. This is just them being absolutely insane and driving up the cost of living. I mean, the idea that you can only have a certain type of car because it has to pass a certain MPG every year and has to have a smog test. And then on top of that, they have different blends of gasoline that can only be sold or bought in California. So gas costs extra there because these refineries are making gas specifically for California. And then people wonder why the cost of living is so high here. It's just, it's ridiculous. So on a very, I don't know, I want to say surface level, but on a very emotional level, I'm like, yeah, good job, Trump. Go after California again. This is something that California needs to get smacked in the mouth to end all of this fucking nonsense. Now, is it in line with states' rights? You can answer that one.
Well, I hate the term states' rights because I don't think states have rights. I don't think groups have rights. I think only individuals have rights. But the question about federalism is an interesting one. I would say that, you know, whether or not you think it's actual federalism, I think the courts have established, whether you like it or not, that basically if the federal government decides to act, then sorry, states, you're screwed. If the federal government doesn't act on a given issue, then states can make up their own minds. And there are a few exceptions to that. But this is a case where apparently the federal government has decided. And through years of court cases, which were mostly through progressive judges, they've essentially said, well, the federal government wants to act, then the state doesn't have the power to override it. The end. Go away, California. William, let's go down the other side of this road a little bit. Why the hell do we have fuel emission standards in the first place? Is this something that's going to combat catastrophic global warming?
I don't think so. I think we've talked about this on a previous show, but anything, even if we wiped out the United States and all of its carbon dioxide emissions tomorrow, China and India will more than make up for it. This is a lot of worry for nothing. Now, there's parts that are you know, we talk about things like smog and things like that, like things that we can actually see and measure and know have a cause and effect relationship to actual livability. There's probably some role here that California may justify different or stricter standards in that case, just because of the geography of places like LA, right? We have the ocean on one side and mountains all the way around. Like, our air gets stale. Things that happen here tend to stay here. Everyone that lived here during the fires knows this, right? Like how smoky it was and how terrible the air quality was. You know, we had to stay home a couple days because the air quality was so bad from the fires. So we know that this is a thing, but we're using this irrational method, this method of almost religious zealotry, right, to try and do this environmental cause by what makes us feel better, right? And paying more at the pump makes us feel better about the environment, even though it won't actually improve it.
It's your penance.
Yeah, it's our penance. And that lets us do other things that without concern for the environment.
It's becoming the universal justifier. And if you look at things like the Green New Deal, which we talked about a few weeks ago, which basically want to control your entire life for the sake of carbon emissions. The great justifier on the left seems to be in the name of fighting global warming. We can propose any absurd thing we want on whatever scale it is, you know, minorly absurd or majorly absurd, and our justification is because otherwise you're all going to die.
Yeah, I think it's even deeper than that. We've replaced our moral judgment, right? Instead of looking at things in terms of individual rights, we've replaced it with this morality of the environment, of the pristine environment, right? Like it, because if you look at all the things that proposed in the Green New Deal, right, that those are all old things that people have proposed before, but you know, people looked at it through the lens of individual rights and said, no, fuck this, right? But if we put on our, if we replace that thinking process, instead of thinking about individual rights, and we think about Mother Gaia and her tears running down her chin from carbon dioxide, then we can, you know, we can justify these things that we want to do, right?
That's
we don't
right.
have to worry about individual rights.
So, Justin, pretty soon they're going to outlaw the production of Funko Pops because the plastic used, you know, the process, it really hurts the environment. And then that's when I think Justin takes to the streets. So,
I mean, they're going to do that with everything. I have no doubt. And another point here is what William was saying about LA in specific, Southern California in specific, and applying those principles outwards. One of the things about the echo chamber here is they think whatever happens in their little world is what's true of the rest of the country, and they want to apply it outwards. I mean, that is the legitimate role of the federal government, right? Making sure that California doesn't set a law that has to apply in Iowa.
Yeah, basically my states in a certain sense. I see where you're going there.
Yeah, and that's the thing about this story that I think is good Trump here, where it's just sort of like, California, you are up your own ass with all of this crap that, A, you're causing to yourself, and B, are a result of you choosing to live here, and you think that's what's true of the rest of the world because of your narcissism. And how about the left, right? When Obama wanted to use this rampant federal power to impose what he wanted from environmental regulations, it was fine. It was good. Now Trump wants to do it for what he thinks is correct, and it's bad.
That's always the hypocrisy of the left, because they think they have the moral compass because they can do the most altruism. So therefore, they're the most right.
Their method, how they get there, is not important. It's never been important to the far left.
And that's, I don't know if it was said on this show. I think I remember it being said. I have a little bit of podcast blackout here. But, you know, if there's any possible good outcome to this, is that the left maybe sees that unlimited unitary executive power or federal government power is a bad thing when it's a guy who does things they don't like. I doubt it, but hopefully, maybe.
Yeah, that was
bit.
William. That was your argument. Was last episode, two episodes ago?
Yeah, my sound argument, my hope, my dream. I have a dream,
and just like Martin Luther King, so.
All right. Well, I think that's a good note to end the news on.
So the country.
The country is fighting with itself, so why don't we talk about a movie that's about fighting with your own group of people? I'm going to do that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. Wasn't focused on
Midsiders out there, if you're enjoying the show, why don't you have a direct conversation with us? Join our Discord channel. It is a great way to interact. I love hearing from you all. I love talking to you during the week. It helps me get ideas for the episode. In fact, a couple of the trailers this week were submitted in our Patreon only channel by Midsider Megan. So go ahead, go to the midside.com/podcast, and you can join our Discord channel and get in the conversation. And, you know, let's witness the farce together during the week. This week, I saw the movie Fighting With My Family. It's executive produced by The Rock. It's the biopic. You know, we've had this slate of biopics that's coming out. This is the new trend of the professional wrestler Paige. She actually doesn't wrestle anymore. She got hurt and she can't continue to wrestle, or it could become even worse for her. Her injury could permanently disable her. So the doctors have taken her out of the ring. But this is a story about how she came from a small, poor town in England, did a WWE tryout, went through their NXT developmental, and became Divas champion, and had a large influence on the current quote-unquote women's revolution in wrestling, where now they're focusing more on the actual wrestling ability of the women and the storytelling, rather than just being like, hey, she's hot, give her the title. The movie ends with her winning the Divas Championship on Raw for the first time ever, which is an actual event. And if you look at what actually happened in reality and the way they romanticized it, then you see that they actually are sticking pretty true to reality. So I'm kind of a couple minds about this movie. The first is that this movie was very enjoyable. Even if you're not a pro wrestling fan, it's just enjoyable to watch. It's someone who's very passionate about what she does, and it's seeing her go through the struggles to achieve greatness in it. And the best way to describe it is a tweet from The Rock. He was replying to Mick Foley, a professional wrestler who wrestled under his own name in Mankind and Dude Love and several gimmicks. And Mick said he really liked it because it really gave you a view of professional wrestling for the first time in a positive way, because we know the naturalistic movie The Wrestler by Darren Aronofsky. Well, The Rock replied in a tweet, and if you look at what he's saying, he's basically summarizing romanticism. I wanted to make a film that amplifies the great qualities and impact our beloved pro wrestling business can have on someone. Could he have said romanticism in a better way? That is a very pragmatic definition of romanticism. So this movie very much romanticizes the struggle and the journey to the top for Paige. And it does that by highlighting the good and minimizing the bad things that happen in reality. I mean, there are negative things that happen to Paige in real life, drug use, sex scandals, where there were tapes that were released of her. But this movie really tracks her journey and really you get behind her and you want to see her succeed. So those are the good things about it. But then I thought about it a little bit more, and this is something that I think Daniel and William, you guys can both weigh in on in movies and I think we have lost the art of the denouement in modern movies, of the falling action. Everything is, the movie builds to the climax, and then there's the climax, and 5 minutes later, the movie is over. That's what happened here. You don't see her wrestle in NXT. You don't see her wrestle through most of the movie. There's a couple wrestling matches, and then she has the match at the end, and she wrestles, and she wins the Divas Championship, and that's it. The movie's over. It just completely climaxes. What if, though, the story told, we actually saw her develop as a wrestler and see her get better and improve, and then she gets called to the main roster, and the falling action is her winning the title. None of this stuff about, she just wins the title and that's it. It just seems to me nowadays we've lost the art of a full story arc, because we begin high and we end high because of this emotionalism in our culture. What do you guys think?
I mean, I think that follows the trend of, having to have visual or some sort of stimuli every 7 minutes or whatever it is in movies, and not being able to have any buildup, for instance. So it doesn't surprise me, and I'm not sure I've noticed it as acutely as you have or thought about it as acutely as you have. But I think if I went for it, I'd probably see the same thing if I was looking for it, because it makes total sense. People's pleasure centers are burned out. They have to have constant stimuli, and being able to deal with something post-climax seems like it's too much of an effort for the modern audience. So it makes sense.
Man, this podcast is all about sex today. Sex. post-coital action in movies.
There's no more cuddling.
We just want to cuddle. I want to cuddle with the characters and the plot a little bit. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting trend now that you've mentioned it. There's a lot of that going on in movies now that I think about some of the last couple movies that I've seen. It takes away a experience of really seeing the character, right? Of feeling the characters actual emotions. If you just see the climax and there's nothing after, then you don't get to live, you don't get to sort of say goodbye to that world or feel that completion of the arc of the emotional journey the characters are on. And it is missed, right? Like it doesn't complete the story without it.
Right. And specifically what's missing from this movie because of it is the middle. And what I mean by that is there was something that was an 8 Mile parody, a parallel. Have either of you seen 8 Mile?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I've seen 8 Mile.
So 8 Mile is the Eminem movie where it's about him freezes up. He can't rap in a freestyle battle. And he does several freestyle battles throughout the movie till finally at the end he doesn't freeze up and he wins. So there's the whole build up there, right? You see his struggle to actually being able to have the self-confidence. Well, it's the same thing here. One of the things Paige is known for in real life is her ability to cut a promo. So, you know, to speak on the microphone, to tell a story on the microphone. Well, in the middle of the movie, they have a promo challenge with her and three of the other women in NXT, and she freezes up literally and doesn't say anything. And then you get to the end of the movie, and at the very end, she freezes up before the match, and then at the end, she speaks. So it's all just the climax there. It's just that, oh, look, she overcomes it. That's the end of the movie. But in real life, she actually, in this match, talked before the match and then won. And then after the match, she just rolled out of the ring with the title and didn't talk. They've undercut the impact of that moment. If you had seen her learn how to embrace her natural storytelling skills and develop those rather than just have it be she can't do it and then she can do it, you would have appreciated her success at the end a lot more. Instead, it just becomes this moment of, yeah, she finally did it. So I would say, in summary, that see this movie if you want to see a romantic journey about someone who is successful and, you know, they're succeeding at their life's journey. And also, there's an interesting, the story they handle about the brother and how you figure out what you're good at and what your life's purpose is, even when your what you believe your dream is taken away from you. It shows how he overcomes that. So there's some really good stuff in here. But don't see it if you completely hate professional wrestling, if you can't look past it and see it as, you know, if you can don't see it as an art form at all. And don't see it if you need a technically proficient movie. This is the best movie that WWE Studios has ever made, but it's still a movie that WWE Studios made. Let's move on to Trailer Takedown. As always, the trailers for the movies are that we're going to talk about are put up on Saturdays on the midside.com. podcast, so you can go there and you can watch all the trailers before the episode, you can watch them after the episode, or you can watch them during. We can talk about one, you can pause it, or you can watch pause us and watch the trailer and then we'll talk about it right after.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Rocket Man is another one of these musical biopics, sort of like the Queen movie Bohemian Rhapsody. One is about Elton John. I don't believe we've talked about this on the show. Mm-hmm. Midsider Megan, this is one of the two she suggested. I included it because I don't remember talking about it. I do remember mocking the shit out of this relentlessly whenever I see it in theaters, so maybe that's why I feel like I've talked about it. There seems to be nothing special about this. I mean, look, Elton John makes good music. I'm not going to argue with that. Rocket Man's been stuck in my head ever since watching this trailer. It's a good song. But literally, the only thing I take away from this fucking trailer is how goddamn confused I get at who the lead actor is. I swear to God, I thought it was Hyde from That 70s Show in this movie for like a month after seeing the original teaser trailer. I didn't realize it was the kid who played Han Solo. Does it not look like Hyde from That 70s Show?
No, it's not the kid. It's not the Han Solo kid.
It's not? Who is it then?
It's the kid from Kingsman.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. But still, that's even more confusing now. Now I've confused two other people. I am tackling the shit out of this.
Tackle?
All right, I'm not that angry. Come on, Daniel.
Yeah, it's what's his name? Taron Egerton.
Yeah, that's it.
That's his name.
But doesn't he look like Hyde from That 70s Show?
He does because there's a lot of 70s dress in this. So this looks exactly like the Bohemian Rhapsody movie. I mean, you sort of stole my thunder in that it was hard. It looks like they were done by the exact same people at the exact same time, using the exact same equipment and directing and whatever. And I still haven't watched Bohemian Rhapsody, although my mother bought me a DVD of it as a present. To which I responded, thank you, and I will never be able to watch this.
Did you ask her if she also got the soundtrack on 8-track for you?
I don't own a DVD player. My computer doesn't have a DVD player. I'll have to buy a DVD player to watch this movie. So I'm never going to watch
Blu-ray, it. Not even Blu-ray, DVD.
Not even Blu-ray, DVD. Thank you, Mom. Appreciate it. But it looks exactly the same. Like, the trailer is cut the same. The whole, like, moment where he's, like, you know, banging out the tune on the piano is sort of follows the same thing. And then his upward trajectory and then the downward spiral. It's the exact same movie. It's just about a different artist. Are we going to see a lot more of these? I mean, I like it in the sense that it's kind of original, but it's how we do original nowadays. Is we need to take a real life story and then we'll make an original screenplay off of it so we don't have to actually think about what the story is. My mother is in love with Elton John. She introduced me to Elton John when I was younger through the song Daniel, right? Of course. And I have appreciation for his music, but I had the same feeling you did, Justin, which is I'm just going to go listen to some Elton John albums and I don't have to watch this movie. Tackle.
Yeah, I can't say anything more than what you said, Daniel. Why would I watch this movie when I can just listen to the albums? So I'm going to tackle.
Second trailer.
Her smell is the answer to what Daniel was just saying. So you're sick of these biopics that are based on real life? What if we give you a biopic that's just completely fictional? Wait, although, is it kind of based on Courtney Love? Midsider Alfred watched this trailer before we even recorded and said a lot of this reminds him of Courtney Love. So I guess we can do these biopics if we just don't name who they're about and we just change the name of the character. So starring Elizabeth Moss, this movie is about this girl in an all-girl punk rock band. And then there's some, like, stuff that happens, maybe. And, like, they get mad at her. I don't know. I don't know what the story of this movie is. My main reaction to this is emotional. I hate this overly grungy look at punk rock. Maybe it's just because I'm more into pop punk. But there's just so much good and so much positivity and so much benevolence and so much individualism and romanticism in punk rock. And then you turn it into this dirty, naturalistic thing. And it's just, it. As much as I like Elizabeth Moss, I don't know if I can morally abide this movie. Tackle. Daniel?
I would watch the Elton John movie 900 times before I watched this movie once. The style is abhorrent to me. The point of the movie looks terrible. I hate, you know, movies about people who are drug addicts, horrible. Like, she's a delinquent mom. Like, what? Why? Reality has too many bad points to it that I would go see art that highlights those things that are bad. Hard tackle.
Tackle.
I didn't say gay hard tackle.
I also looked at this and said, why? Why do we have to tell this story? Is it because she's a woman? As a woman, I can ask this question and you guys can't? So, yeah, I'm going to tackle this.
Tackle. Final trailer.
The Kid is a retelling of the Billy the Kid myth. Here was what was compelling to me about this trailer. So I was watching it and I was like, okay, this is a typical Western. We don't have a lot of Westerns. Oh, this could be cool. And then I saw that Vincent D'Onofrio is the director. And I was like, wait a second. Because he has a very artistic and very unique style as an actor. So I'm very interested in how that translates to a movie. Then you look at the cast. Ethan Hawke is good. Dane DeHaan is good. Chris Pratt is in it. And then finally, this movie, ironically, I'm going to talk about the climax of this trailer. This trailer climaxed with an amazing line. I don't remember. I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't remember the exact line. But the idea that it doesn't matter what actually happened. It matters what the story they tell when you're gone is. If this movie, coming from someone who's been involved with Hollywood all this time, is a traditional Western and makes the point about the way narrative is controlled by media and by the way people are socially, it has huge potential. This trailer makes me very excited. I'm hugging.
Hug.
Daniel?
I would say that this is the most intriguing trailer for a Western I may have ever seen in my adult life. I don't remember, you know, what the Tombstone trailer was, and that was probably better, and it's certainly going to be a better movie than what this will be. But I will say that I was intrigued enough that I wasn't disgusted by it. Westerns in the modern era, the postmodern era, have gone very dark and gritty and horrible, and how you'd expect they would go. And this one didn't. This one had an old Western feel to it. That being said, I'm just not that into Westerns. So I'm not going to lie to you and say that I would see it, even though I found it mildly intriguing. I'm going to have to tackle, but it's a respectful tackle.
Tackle.
All right. I saw guns. I saw character dialogue and interaction. I saw actual story being sort of like hinted at these in a Western, and it doesn't look all. It doesn't look like it's going to be about social justice. It looks like it's actually going to have universal themes, which is interesting. So I am intrigued, and I'm going to hug this.
Hug.
Well, right, I invoked the rule of threes.
Yeah, there you go.
So which movie quickly, are you going to
watch? I will say
that
if I had to watch one of these, I would watch Rocket Man just for the music.
Really?
Really?
Not even
the Western?
Kid?
Yeah. Wow.
Nope.
Wow.
Nope. I'm just not into Westerns. I'm just
I'm just going to pick on you a little bit because this is it is a myth, but it is an original story, right? It's more original than telling the story of Elton John. Seems to fit your criteria.
Yeah, I mean, I get all that, and I'm a big old hypocrite. But I don't know. I just feel
that,
like
it's that white privilege you have of being a hypocrite.
It's that half white privilege I have.
Jay,
I just can't. I can't sit through Westerns. I've tried to watch so many Westerns, including some of the best Westerns ever made. I'm bored every single time. There's too much staring into the sunset for me.
Cool guys don't look at explosions, Daniel. All right, are we ready to go into the last segment here and talk about how we can like talk to people on a daily basis?
Sure.
Always.
All right, let's do it in Life on the Midside. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic goes on. Cause I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. Man, Daniel, I have to agree with you. You said something last episode where you were like, the music is really good on the show. I did a good job.
The
music.
I'm jamming out every
first
time.
I've heard that.
You know who that is. That's Bowling for Soup.
Oh, is it? I didn't recognize
that. Yeah.
Every time Daniel hears Bowling for Soup, he's like, they're really good. Who are they? Every time.
Every single time. I just need to buy all their albums and be done with it.
All right. So what I want to talk to you guys about this week is I don't want to talk about the craft stuff again. I want to talk about talking to people about the craft stuff. And what I mean by that is immediately after it happened, I had to start bracing myself because my reaction was I just started laughing. Daniel can even tell you, or if you follow the Midside on Instagram, you can see all the texts I had with my friends, with people like Daniel, where it just became a big joke to me almost immediately. Where all I could think about was like, yeah, this is going to give us our 7th Super Bowl title. Because we know the truth of Deflategate. We know the truth of Spygate. Now we know what's going on with this, whatever gate we're going to call this. But other people don't. They only hear the narrative they're told, right? We were talking about with the Jussie Smollett thing that it's all about the narratives that people are telling. Even in the kid trailer, it's all about the narratives that you know people tell when you're gone. And it's the same thing here. I found myself having to explain Deflategate again to people. where they're like, oh God, you guys are doing something bad again. And I had to go back and explain that. And then I had to, even on this basic level, I had to explain what a misdemeanor was. And I had to explain what he's actually accused of. So for me, the difficulty becomes, I can either choose to continue to explain these things. I can come up with coping techniques. Like at one point I sat down to a meeting with someone who I knew was a Broncos fan. And I said to him, okay, you have 2 minutes to say whatever you want about Kraft right now. And he did. I said my rebuttal and then we moved on. Or I can just choose not to talk to people. I'd like to be a social creature. So how do I go about this without having to explain constantly? They tried to destroy our coach. That didn't work. They tried to destroy our quarterback. That didn't work. Now they're trying to destroy our owner. How do you have a conversation about something with people where they don't know anything about it, but they think they know things about it, but what they think they know is the exact opposite?
Man, that might just be called, how do you have a conversation with people?
Yeah.
Well, right.
Because that, I mean, everyone, just about everyone, but I'll say everyone for ease, has some element of their life where they're an expert. I mean, that might just be your own being, your own life, where you're an expert and you have knowledge other people don't, and they have cursory knowledge, be it from the news or from pop culture or from sort of just being around you, if it's something like your own life. And I think the first thing for me is always assessing what value do I give this person? So if it's someone who's close to me, I'll spend exponentially more time fixing a misconception about something than I will if it's a stranger.
You mean because like 10 years with the Patriots?
That's right. Because it's really important that you order your values here. It's really important that you understand where you choose to put your time into something. And I don't think it's actually in your self-interest to put an inordinate amount of time in correcting misconceptions from people who aren't a value to you, who aren't even a potential value to you, someone who's in fact antagonistic to your values. And so while I do believe in saying if you disagree with something, especially in a social context, and at least leaving it at that, I don't think you are obligated in any way to go into the correction. You can just say, that's all false. And if you want to learn more, Google it or talk to me at some point or something. But just outright saying, no, that's not true. You know, fake news, whatever you want to do. I'll let William talk a little bit before I go into other techniques here.
Yeah, I think for me, I run into this a lot, and it's just about thinking about what I'm getting out of the relationship, and if it's worth it, if the conversation is going to be worthwhile to me to even have, right? Because what does this really matter in terms of my relationship with individual people, right? So it really depends. It's very contextual. It depends on what value is at stake and what value the person is to me.
Yeah.
Can I mention something that's sort of the converse of what you said, which sort of makes this more difficult?
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you that everyone's sort of an expert on different things, right? But how many people nowadays talk about things that they're not an expert on as if they are, and think they're experts on things beyond what they are? And I think that's what makes this an added level of difficulty, is everyone thinks they're an expert on everything. Like, I don't like what it's a joke, right? It's a joke that I always talk about the Patriots. It's a joke that I talk about Zack Snyder. It's a joke that I talk about pop punk. But these are the things I know. I talk about the things I know. You can make fun of me for, but it doesn't that make me a moral person because I'm only talking about things I know? And if I don't know, I ask or I listen.
Yeah, unfortunately, to answer your question, it's damn near everyone who talks about something they're not an expert in. And, don't throw me out of the movement, but objectivists tend to be a little guilty of this, especially because they have an understanding of a philosophy which they think makes them an expert in all of reality. It's just not how that works, objectivists. Again, don't expel me. I love you all.
All right. I tore into Ayn Rand on the second part of the M. Night live stream with Midsider Katrina. I was pretty critical of her. So
how dare you? That's it. Gone. Out of the movement.
Yep. Excommunicated.
You're a horrible human. Excommunicated. But I think
you were ordinated. How can you excommunicate? Don't excommunicate me.
I'm ordinated. I'm an ordinal number. So dealing with people and the expertise. So again, it's about the value to you. But if you do find them valuable and you want, and they're somewhere on that hierarchy of values and you want to correct an error, then it's sort of starting to me, and this is getting in a little bit about what persuasion is, but first seeing like what there's a certain order of operations to arguments in the same way that there is math. You shouldn't start on the outer stuff, on the surface level stuff. You need to start at the core. You need to start at, is there something here that if I triggered the downfall of that thing, the whole house of cards would come crumbling down? To use Spygate as an example, if the person I'm talking to has some fundamental understanding of football and is, you know, obviously if they're fundamentally honest, but they have a misconception about what Spygate is, I might ask them the question, for instance, so-and-so, let's say the name's John. John, to this day, is it permissible or impermissible to film hand signals at practices? And of course, they'll go, well, you can't do that. That's what Bill Belichick was taken down for, was filming hand signals. And I will say, false. Unequivocally false. To this day, to right now, to this very day, it is permissible. You just cannot do it from field level. You must do it from the stands or vice versa. I forget the specific thing. And Bill Belichick was dinged for doing the opposite one. And that's all there is to it. And if they have any bit of honesty, they'll go, oh, is that really it? And usually that's the end of the Spygate discussion. For people who are less honest, you'll go down the road, but it has to be more than that. I heard he was stealing playbooks and I heard he was wiretapping, locker rooms. And at that point, you have to reassess. You have to continually be assessing the value of continuing this conversation to you. What is the value of continuing? Especially if you learn new information, the person is not going to be honest about the conversation, or at least they don't care about the reality of it. They only care about their narrative. And at that point you can go, that's all false. If you want to research it, it's out there. Peace.
Yeah. I think the other thing. Oh, go ahead.
Hold on. I have a joke.
Okay.
Oh man. Stop the presses.
Daniel. So you're saying that you have to find the one thing that if you take it down, it takes down the whole house of cards.
Yeah. It's you take that one thing away from them, they can still beat you, power to them, but they're not going to be able to. So.
Right. So all you do is you find the Kevin Spacey of their point of view.
Oh, I thought we were going the Bill Belichick route here, but I guess we'll go the Kevin Spacey route. Yes, you find their Kevin Spacey, and then that takes down the whole house of cards.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. William, please salvage that.
So we talked about the what to do. I want to talk a little bit about the approach, like the how to do it. I think for me, I like to kind of approach it very benevolently and like surprised, you know? The conversation isn't like, oh, this person is attacking me because they have a different view from me, right? Or that they don't have the right facts. Like somehow that's like a moral failing on their part, right? You know, it's very much like, huh, oh, no, I don't think that's right. And here's what I know. And like, here's the facts that I have. Does that jive with what you know, right? It's more like discovery and benevolence is my initial approach. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to treat someone dishonest, you know, with that level of courtesy and respect, but you want to start with that, right? You don't want to sour if this person's actually value to you and you think that you have something that can, increase their knowledge or their life or correct an error in their thinking or whatever, they have an incorrect view on something. You're approaching it benevolently because it's like, oh, this is great. Just like I would want someone to approach me benevolently, if I had some, obvious error in some fact that I knew. I think a lot of these kinds of conversations can quickly devolve into something hostile. And it's just like, hey, this wasn't, this isn't like, we can disagree, right? It's cool if we disagree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not if you're from Boston.
And if you've decided to engage with someone and that they're of value to you, do you want to convince them? Know that nothing happens immediately. Persuasion usually takes time, but as long as you're benevolent about it and you're right, then it will happen if the person is intellectually honest. But there are techniques you can use that we don't want to get into all of them on this show. There's a gajillion. There's a whole art. There's a whole field of study called rhetoric out there. But a great introduction to learning how to persuade better is a book called Thank You for Arguing. Again, that's Thank You for Arguing by J. Heinrich, H-E-I-N-R-I-C-H. But I think what makes the book so accessible is that it takes the sort of art of rhetoric and distills it into modern and pop culture examples, especially looking at he looks a lot at like Star Wars and The Simpsons and TV shows to show examples of how you argue with people. So check
about in my master's thesis.
Yes, indeed.
Wow, I'm a genius.
It shouldn't go without saying, show that Justin is a genius.
All right, on that note, let's end the episode. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that Trump has attacked me 92 times and I didn't even
93.
Notice. 93, and I didn't even notice.
That's right.
Daniel?
Well, I learned about fuel economy in California and that they're even crazier than I thought they were, that when these regulations on fuel economy are lifted a little bit, they scream bloody murder and go, no, we want it harder for people to make cars here. We want to make it harder for people to sell vehicles. So California is committing slow suicide yet again. Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned the importance of really taking a step back. And I think, Daniel, you did a tremendous job of taking a step back in the Jussie Smollett story and seeing all sides of it, which is what we're all about in the Midside here, seeing how the farce is inside of everything rather than, you know, we could have just taken the typical position of attacking Jussie Smollett for what he did. But seeing the other forces at work that made the story farcical really is a good reminder of just how big of a step back you have to take.
That's right. Well, if you like taking steps back with us here at The Midside, we appreciate it. And you can help us even more by going to themidside.com/podcast and listening to past episodes. That's always fun when I get tweets about things that happened years ago that people listen to. That's kind of cool. You can also subscribe.
How often does this happen to you?
Not very often, but once in a blue moon, people will tweet me and say like, hey, really funny joke from season four.
I feel like the show has backfired and Daniel is the true star.
Yeah. Someone's going to start digging up the old lost episodes and commenting on those.
Oh, God. Please don't. So many of those will get me fired. So thanks for that. You can also subscribe and get the latest episodes delivered to you immediately as soon as they're published. If you go to Apple Podcasts or Google Play and subscribe there anywhere podcasts are distributed. Leave us 5-star reviews there. That helps us move up the rankings and kick the butt of people like Welcome to the Beehive and other crap. So we appreciate our 5-star reviews, even if you hate the show, 5 stars. Midside.com/store to get your Midside swag. Patreon.com/themidside, where you can contribute a couple bucks every time we produce a piece of content. That really helps us keep the lights on and do things like buy me a microphone, Justin, or pay for advertising or buy me a microphone, Justin. Any number of things like that, like buying me a microphone, Justin. All sorts of things. But if you can't do that, that's totally fine. We understand that money is tight. You can always, though, always, and in fact, often, tell a friend about the show. Telling a friend about the show is the number one way friends are told about the show. True. Studies have shown that you telling your friends is the way that your friends find out. So do that. Helps us grow the Midside, helps us look at the farce with lots more people. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us, libertarians, what. And until next time, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Wozneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a huge step, witness the farce.
Have a day.
I think we made it through that entire episode without saying the words Tom and Brady together.
Whoa.
That's I did say quarterback for the New England Patriots, though.
You did, but you didn't say Tom. Also, you're going to have to silence all of my audio when I'm speaking because I think my son was crying the entire episode. So
I didn't hear it. On our side, yeah.
All right, well.
Also, yeah. We need to release a soundtrack or maybe a biopic of all the music.
A Spotify playlist.
Yeah, Spotify playlist. That's good.
They're all on the Midside Workout playlist on Spotify.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We'll have to, you should plug that sometime, yeah, like we'll right now.
I have plugged it a bunch.
A bunch. A bunch.